You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to the Ready Room, show number 74, The Magic Clone Bean. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Greg Harbin. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including a TNG 25th anniversary lithograph from Bye Bye Robot, new collectibles and reissues from Diamond Select, the danger real-life warp drive could pose to planets, the results of another series preference poll, and some movie news and rumors. Could we be seeing the end of Quinto Spock? Then in the feature, we're joined by Doug Mirabello and Jose Munoz to discuss the third season Enterprise episode, Similitude. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Greg. How are you this week?
I am mixed, Chris, to be honest. I just found out that not only has Last Resort been canceled, but also two of my favorite podcasts, Build and Analyze and Hypercritical, have been canceled. I'm basically on a downward slope. I'm taking Xanax by the handful. Things are not looking good.
Now, I don't recall you ever talking about those two podcasts on our podcast. So what happened? Why are they canceled?
I don't know. I didn't even realize that I could affect it. I know I've been listening to the podcast since they started. Maybe I talked about them in real life too much. I wasn't aware my power extended so far. I'm quite perturbed, actually.
It does seem like it is now extending itself into your actual everyday life. So you need to be careful.
I'm going to be very careful. I'm going to start not talking about anything that I like at all. So, yeah, look forward to my upcoming podcast about Real Housewives of New Jersey, WrestleMania, and Samsung Galaxy Tab 5 10.2 HD with Windows 8.
All right. Okay. I'm looking forward to that.
Coming soon from Trek FM. How are you doing, Chris?
I'm doing fine. Very, very busy as always. Mm. We've had just a lot of stuff going on. We've talked on the last Ready Room about some of the new shows that we've launched on the network here. And I was very happy that yesterday, Matthew and I launched our latest show. We have too many shows now, I think, but a lot of them are niche shows. And this one is. This one is called Literary Treks, and it is devoted exclusively to Star Trek novels, comics, and the occasional reference book. So finally, there's an outlet where we can discuss the extended universe and do so with people who have read the books, read the comics, and we can get into spoilers. And a big thing we're doing that I love is just interviewing authors.
Yeah, I love it that you're getting authors on. I know you've got at least a couple interviews lined up that I'm really excited for. And I'm hoping that by listening to these, I can get a sense of what the books are like. And maybe that'll even get me into reading the books again, as I've sort of gotten out of reading Star Trek novels. I like the comics an awful lot, but the novels just seem like such a thing to get into. But listening to these interviews, maybe that'll get me more pumped.
The interviews are really interesting because you get a lot of behind the scenes information or a view, you know, of how these novels are put together and how the editors work together.
Right.
So the first show is out right now. We talked to Dayton Ward, and we talked about his new novella, In Tempest's Wake, as well as the overall development of Vanguard. And then next week, we have a really fascinating interview with Kirsten Baer, who is the author who's writing all of the Voyager novels now in the continuation of Voyager. So really fascinating. And everyone can just go to trek.fm/LT. That's for Literary Treks. And you'll find the show there. And it's going to be in iTunes and on Stitcher any day now, probably by the time this Ready Room comes out.
Very cool.
So I hope everyone enjoys that.
Very cool. Very cool. So what do we have up in news today, Chris?
Well, the first thing we have in news is a new print from the wonderful art studio Bye Bye Robot, and this one is celebrating the 25th anniversary of The Next Generation.
Right, and it's a very cool, you know, last time we were talking about those Enterprise covers that showed the cast, but not really the whole cast, and I was talking about and, you know, on the Blu-ray, where's Crusher and where's Troy? So what Bye Bye Robot has put together is basically a cast photo for the core TNG cast. And it's really rather cool. It's not just cast pictures against a bland background. It's got the three main colors, you know, the red, the gold, the blue, and it's got all of our, you know, main seven people from TNG.
It is really nice. And like you said, it does have the main seven people. I did notice a striking omission here, which is that Argyle is not in the image.
Yes, I'm sure Argyle and Roe and Yar and Pulaski and Wesley are on the other side. Maybe you can flip it over and there they are all hanging out in a Jeffrey's tube together.
it's like an old album. You had a B-side.
Yes.
That's the B-side of this lithograph.
Yes, exactly. But it's really cool. And for the TNG fan who's looking for something striking to go up on his wall, this is really fantastic. It's almost Drew Struzan in that it's got gigantic heads, but they're stylized in such a way that it's cartoony without looking like a cartoon, and it's realistic without being, you know, sometimes they try to make it look too realistic, and so they end up not looking like the actors themselves.
Right.
Whereas all of these are rather spot-on likenesses.
Oh, they are. They absolutely are. And again, this is a lithograph, so even though when you go to the website and you look at this, you can get a great idea of what it looks like, but I have to imagine that it's many, many times more striking in person.
Oh, yeah.
When you see it at its full 18 by 24 inch size. Unfortunately, there's one problem with this for me, Greg, and I actually talked to Charity at Bye Bye Robot about this a little bit. This is available in the U.S. only, and I asked Charity about the Ryza poster. Do you remember the Ryza travel poster that we talked about a few months ago? And I said I would love to have that on my wall here in the studio. I wish I could get it sent here to Japan. And she told me that they really want to make these available internationally, but unfortunately, they only have a license to sell these inside the United States from CBS.
Right. Licensing, the bane of our existence.
Well, I know, right?
I guess you could always have someone in the States buy it for you and then ship it there. That just adds a whole bunch of complications, though.
Of course. It's kind of odd to me. And again, I work in publishing. I've worked in publishing my whole career now, almost 20 years. I understand how licensing works, and I know about all the geographic elements of licensing. I just find it weird that something like posters are going to be limited only to the United States. I do hope that, you know, the world's getting very small these days. I do hope that CBS and other people who license franchise properties will kind of lighten up a little bit and make sure that fans all around the world can get their hands on all this great stuff.
Well, yeah, but I mean, for now, at least you have the Japanese licensee of Star Trek, which is, of course, Sanrio, and you've got that great poster with the Hello Kitty Enterprise D, sort of waving to you, and you've got, you've got all of them dressed up in the Hello Kitty outfits. You can get them on purses and little wallets. So, you know, you really want to make sure that Sanrio has the whole Star Trek license locked down.
I have to tell you, the Hello Kitty version of the Enterprise is just one of the cutest ships you've ever seen.
It really is.
I like
is.
How they did the... You know, hello. Another Sanrio property is My Melody, or My Mero-chan, as we say in Japanese.
Yes.
And I love how they did the warp nacelles in the Enterprise. They're actually like My Melody's ears flopping backwards.
And I really like how they integrated the bow on the engineering section. I believe that's actually where the battle bridge is inside of the bow.
It is, actually. And it can separate. So during battle, the bow actually flies off. It's actually capable of warp 1.7 under its own power.
I think I've heard that.
All right. Well, if you're interested in this, it's by artist Tracy Ching. It's available at byebyerobot.com. Just click over there. It's the TNG 25th anniversary litho and selling, I believe, for $24.95. And quite beautiful. Would make a great gift for your TNG fan. Yeah. For the holidays.
Right. And speaking of things that would make great gifts, We've got the first look at the new Seven of Nine statue that's coming to us from Diamond Select, which if you've ever wanted a 9-inch tall replica of Seven of Nine in all of her silver catsuit glory, well, this is your chance.
Now, when I saw this one, Greg, you were the first person I thought of because I was just picturing over, you know, behind your desk over there against the wall, your Empress Hoshi statue looks a little bit lonely, I have to admit. You know, she's been there now for what, about 9-10 months since mm-hmm. you finished her? She's getting a little bit lonely, and I thought that this 9-foot statue of Seven of Nine would be ideal. So, of course, you can't get that one from Diamond Select, but you could get this one, use it as a model, and then build your own Seven of Nine statue.
Well, the 9-foot one comes from Latinum Select, which is the even higher quality Star Trek licensee here in the States. They've been working very hard at making me that Seven of Nine. That's 9 foot tall. Yes, it's rather imposing, actually, when it comes right down to it, because not only is it Seven of Nine, but she's even got heels on. Yeah. So
you're feeling a little bit intimidated in your own room there, right, Greg?
Yeah, a little bit. I'm going to have to start taking back what's mine. This is a really cool one. Good for, I guess, putting on your desk along with your Kirk Bear and all those other things. I think she would intimidate the Kirk Bear pretty much as much as my 9 foot tall Seven intimidates me.
She probably would, but if you keep an eye on my Instagram, you'll find out that Kirk Bear would still be hitting on her anyway.
I think that's quite true. Is this honestly, I'm looking at it again, is this honestly what they put Jerry Ryan in for Voyager?
Yep.
Is it honestly like this skin tight silver reflecty catsuit with like built in heels?
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Yeah.
And there's like a corset thing going on. But it's not really.
Yeah. At least later they let her have the maroon. Looked like it was a little bit more comfortable. Although I have to say my favorite of Jerry Ryan on Voyager was probably in episodes like, was it Relativity, where she's wearing the normal Starfleet science uniform with her hair down?
She wears it really well. You know, they sort of do the same thing with T'Pol, where they just put her in the weirdest outfits. And when they finally get her in the regular uniform in an episode like Twilight, you're like, oh, wow, she actually looks really good. Why aren't they doing that all the time? And Jerry Ryan really pulls off the regular uniform. So maybe if we lobby really hard, Diamond Select can come out with the regular Starfleet uniform version of Seven of Nine.
Maybe so.
For those of us who maybe have, you know, families and children around that maybe this is not appropriate for.
Perhaps. All right, but this is coming out anyway. It's supposed to be out in the summer, so you'll have to wait a little while to get this. It's going to sell for $45. But this is not the only thing that's coming out from Diamond Select. There are quite a few things that are available now. One of them is a new item, and we have several others that are reissues. So what's the new item, Greg?
Yeah, the one I'm really excited for is the... it's basically a figure set from Space Seed, and it is Kirk doing battle with Khan, and I believe that this is in engineering. Khan's even holding a pipe, and they're in sort of action poses. This is fantastic. This is like really good. It's not just like with the Seven where she's just standing there. They're actively in battle. You can see a look of determination on Kirk's face, and this one is only $25. So I may actually be hitting buy now on my iPad as we record this episode.
Yeah, this is an interesting one, and it makes me wonder what is going to be next in this series of action pose figures from Diamond Select. And it's actually sculpted by Art Asylum. It's being released by Diamond Select. Mm-hmm. And one that I'm definitely hoping for is I want to have the Andorian fight scene.
Yes. Well, I mean, maybe they could just release an Andorian that you can put into any of the other Diamond Select figures. So you have Kirk doing battle with Khan, but just add this Andorian and suddenly becomes a Andorian fight scene right there in Space Seed. Or you can have the Andorian show up and he's fighting Seven of Nine. Basically, wherever you want, the Andorian can be there.
This is like a good idea. So he would have to be poseable, of course.
Oh, yeah.
But you can insert him into any scene
that
you want.
Of course, the Andorian comes with 47 points of articulation.
Very good, very good. The other one I'm looking forward to is the figure from These Are the Voyages, the supposed finale to Enterprise, the figure of Trip crossing the wires.
Yes. For when you want to recreate that moment where Trip really wants to make sure Archer makes it home in time for the speech. But what I'm really looking forward to is the figure from Generations, where, of course, Geordi has to do a barrel roll to get out of engineering before they all blow up. So I think, I'm not sure, does he do the barrel roll, like, does he slide back and forth? Or maybe he's mid-barrel roll as they've captured
him? I'm picturing mid-barrel roll. That's what I'm picturing. Because I think that freeze frame action that you would get there would capture that moment.
Nice.
Very good. Now, of course, it has a button that you can press, and when you press it, steam and smoke actually flies out from underneath the blast door as it's coming down.
Perfect. Perfect. I think those are really great ones coming soon from Diamond Select, of course.
It is, but you're forgetting about the most important one, Greg. There is one more in the series.
Mm-hmm.
This is the one, it's Riker, and it comes with a set of like 24 different visiting female dignitaries. And you can mix and match, and you can insert different characters into the scene, and Riker hits on them all.
I thought you were going to say the Riker one has his leg just up on, and just a series of things that you can have his leg up on.
Right, yeah, that's there too. That's why that one is going to sell for an extra $10, because... You know, it's just added value.
Yes. So at the same time that we're talking about future products, there are some past products that they're reissuing. And a couple of these are really rather cool. And then one of them I really love. We're looking at the next-gen Enterprise D. So it's the 16-inch long, working lights, all of that. Very nice-looking Enterprise D. And then they've got the one from All Good Things as well, with the third nacelle, which lets them do something. I'm not clear on that. But if you really love All Good Things and you like that futuristic D that never happened because Troy crashed the ship, Diamond Select's got both of them available for $70.
Right. Those are going to be $70. And they both include voices if you press a button. Now, the regular 1701D from the series has the voice of Patrick Stewart as Captain Picard. Now, apparently the one from All Good Things also has the voice of Patrick Stewart as Picard. However, what you mostly hear is Riker telling him to go back to his quarters.
Nice.
But it is good to see these reissued, because I have the 1701E that was released right when First Contact came out.
Mm-hmm.
And these ships are... You know, they release them and then they're gone, and they can be a little bit hard to get your hands on years later. And so if you've been wanting these, you can pick them up now, as well as the Star Trek Communicator and Tricorder set from the original series.
And this one I really love because they're, you know, life size. The Tricorder's the one that you sort of strap around your neck and comes with a little piece that you can use for probing. These are really, really, really cool.
These are. Now, this looks like I can picture Sheldon, you know, going to the Renaissance Festival, dressed as Spock, carrying this around his shoulder.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. Does it have all the sounds? Like, can I flip it open and make it chirp for me?
I'm pretty sure. I don't have a list of, you know, every sound that it makes, but... It does say it has authentic sounds and lights, and I would expect that it's probably got you know a decent variety of sounds.
I remember when I was a kid, of course, you could buy the TNG communicator lapel pin and the tricorder. Of course I had a tricorder. Like, what kid didn't have a TNG tricorder? But I don't think back in the 60s they made a a TOS tricorder that you could have. I feel like it was not really the sort of thing they made back then. So to have them issue something like that now is really cool. And especially for people nostalgic for that original series.
Definitely so. Yeah, I don't think there was anything quite like that. Although there was that bizarre Spock helmet with like the flashing light on top. Have you seen that
before? I've not. Buy a Spock helmet? Nice.
It's weird. You'll find it online. I've come across it a few times. It's a toy from, I think it's actually from the 70s, but, and it's Star Trek branded, and it's some kind of helmet, and it's got like a blue police light on top. And I don't know what it's from. I don't know how it ties into the show. It's the strangest thing you've ever seen. But tricorder, no, I don't think you've seen that. Yeah. But this set is going to sell for $75. And all of these things, the two ships and the tricorder communicator set, are available now. And the Kirk action figure is available now as well. The Riker flirtation set and foot prop is not available yet, but keep your eyes open for that.
Coming very soon. So pretty much anybody on your Christmas list, I think you can get them something from Diamond Select that they'll appreciate. If nothing else, they'll appreciate the 7 of 9.
So, Greg, moving on, we have a different story. Believe it or not, this is not about toys, but this is about science. And I saw this interesting article in the Daily Mail from the UK the other day. And scientists are speculating that if we were to build an actual real-life warp drive, that the act of using that to travel to another planet could result in the destruction of that planet when the ship comes out of warp.
Yeah, and that's not good, right?
That's not good, I mean, no.
The whole point is you travel to the other planet and then you get to visit it. Although, I mean, it would work really well if you're trying to blow it up. Like, you know, the Death Star has to go all the way to Alderaan and then sort of get close and then have to fire the weapon. It has to. If the Death Star could have just gone whoop and come out of warp right next to Alderaan and then just caused a giant explosion, it really would have saved the Emperor a lot of time.
It is your destiny.
Really, it would have. And that's actually the angle that they take in this article. They say that warp drive could turn spacecraft into Death Stars. But yeah, the thing about the Death Star in Star Wars is that I feel like you have a lot of advance notice. It's kind of like if we detected a comet, you know, out around the orbit of Pluto that's going to circle around and maybe hit us on its third trip around the sun.
Right.
That's about how long it takes the Death Star to get to a planet, I feel. Because it's kind of like, I feel like, you know, it's like Darth Vader, he's in there. It's like he's riding on a lark. And he's just very slowly making his way towards whatever planet.
Well, instead of impulse or warp or any of that, they just got a bunch of stormtroopers that are sort of rowing the boat with these gigantic space.
That's what I was picturing too.
Yes. So they just...
on the side, it's so large you don't notice really, but if you zoom in, you can see the little openings on the side of the Death Star and you can see the space oars sticking and rowing.
Yes. All in unison. That's what actually what the Imperial March is used for. Just bum, bum, pull, bum, ba-bum, pull, ba-bum.
Pull. Exactly. John Williams knew what he was doing.
He absolutely did. But yes, yeah, so, but I mean, at least they're saying this is possible. I mean, before we were saying warp drive isn't possible in the slightest.
Right. Now some researchers think that the energy needed for warp drive may not be quite so impossible to achieve as we once thought. Of course, it's still beyond our current technology, but, you know, one day maybe we would be able to do that. But they talk about something that Star Trek fans, of course, are quite familiar with, which is the creation of what in Star Trek we call a warp bubble. But it would be a stable pocket of space that surrounds the ship. But as the ship is traveling, then these particles would fill up that pocket of space. And what they're saying would happen is that when the ship comes out of warp, all of these built-up particles would be projected forward away from the ship, which could result in them hitting the planet and actually vaporizing the planet. And as you said, that's not good.
It's not really the plan. So I guess now they need to figure out how can we disperse this energy in a way that's not harmful. Obviously, we found a way to harness nuclear reactions in a way that doesn't typically explode and blow everything up, but just generates power. So it's a matter of figuring out what we can do with that energy, dissipate it slowly or run it through something. I'm not an engineer, certainly not a warp engineer. But it's good that we've got people working on these problems, right? Like Zefram Cochrane, I'm sure, was looking at research like this when he was putting together the Phoenix.
Right. It is good that people are taking it seriously. Mm-hmm. I still feel that there's so much we don't know about the universe, so much we don't know about science. And it's very easy for us to think that we know everything and to say that this is not possible. But, you know, you never know what we're going to discover 100 years, 200 years, 300 years from now.
Right.
And so the fact that people are taking it seriously and working on it makes me believe that even if it's not exactly like it is in Star Trek, that we will one day have these engines that allow us to at least travel to stars that aren't too terribly far away from us. So we won't be locked in our own little solar system forever.
Yeah. And if nothing else, we'll, you know, just do our jump to a planet we don't really like very much, and then we can use impulse power to get to the planet we like.
That's right. I prefer to use 1/4 impulse power myself. But, you know, if you want to go full impulse, go right ahead. Be my guest. All right. Well, let's move on to another Star Trek story, Greg. We like to talk about the results of StarTrek.com polls on the Ready Room, just to, you know, see how you and I feel about these ourselves. And the most recent poll asked, the one Trek show you'd watch forever is... And who was the winner of this poll?
Yeah, well, the winner for this one is kind of predictable. It's TNG. And I say predictable because I guess it had the most variety of stories. Also, it is the most well-liked of the series. So it came in at 42%. Next was DS9 with 19%. Then Voyager with 17%. TOS with 16%. And then Enterprise with 6%. I'm actually surprised to see a TOS... not higher, although I guess fewer episodes.
Yeah, I think it's a generational thing. You know, I think that those of us who grew up with TOS, there are a lot more fans in the fan community now who grew up with TNG and Voyager. And notice I leave DS9 out there because I think a lot of those fans skipped DS9. And then mm-hmm. we have a lot of fans, as you know, from our Twitter account, who grew up with Voyager as their very first series. And we talked about this, you know,
in
recent polls. But I think for TNG, again, as everyone who listens to us regularly knows, my favorite series is Deep Space Nine. But I will say that when I just feel like I want to watch Star Trek and I just want to pop in an episode of Star Trek, I more often than not will probably pop in TNG because it's just really accessible. You know, you can just throw an episode on and you can just watch it and enjoy some Star Trek, and you don't have to get too invested in what's going on. And it's kind of a relaxing way to enjoy Star Trek.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's really true. I mean, I would personally say the one series I'd want to watch forever would be Battlestar Galactica. So say we all!
I don't think that was in the poll, Greg.
But I guess if I had to be stuck with a Star Trek series... as this is a Star Trek podcast, I'd probably, probably go with TNG. With actually, you know, DS9 might be a close second for me, just because it did have a really cool long-term storyline. And this is a hard one to say. You know, one thing that's great about Star Trek is there's so much to it that whatever mood you're in, you can jump into a certain series, a certain type of episode, you know, whether you're feeling like Mike Sussman, whether you're feeling like Brandon Braga, whether you're feeling like Ron Moore, or Michael Piller, or Gene Roddenberry. There's all these different feelings and writers and casts that you can watch. So I kind of don't like the concept of this question because if Star Trek was just one series, I don't think it would have near the following that it has.
Right. I did see there were some quotes on the page. If you go to StarTrek.com and you look at the results page, and we'll put a link to this in the show notes, and actually in the enhanced here, if you tap your screen, there were a few comments from some people who voted in the poll. And I do remember one person who said that for me, it's all part of one big, long saga. It's this one big universe. And so it's kind of hard to choose just one in that case. And I kind of agree with that.
Yeah, I mean, how can you follow that story thread of the Andorian if you don't see from very beginning to very end?
Right, yeah. I mean,
what's the Andorian fighting for if you exactly. if you leave out DS9?
Why does this Andorian keep fighting with everyone in every episode? You know, it had to start somewhere, and you need to go back and you have to find out. And yeah. really, ultimately, the only person that can answer that question is Jeffrey Combs.
He is everywhere.
All right. So this was an interesting poll. I think the two things that were interesting to me are the margin of victory for TNG, 42% over all the other series, mm-hmm. and the fact that DS9 was second and Voyager was third. I would have expected that to be flipped around just based on fan interaction that we've had.
Right. Yeah.
So, Greg, as we move into movie news and rumors, I have to ask you, do you think that we are looking at saying goodbye to Zachary Quinto as Spock?
Yeah, and this is a story, one of those ones that sort of came out of nowhere with like one quote and then a ton of speculation based on one quote. So I guess it comes down to what Zachary Quinto told Entertainment Weekly. While talking about American Horror Story Asylum, which he's on now. Basically, he says he's looking to go in a different direction. The quote is, "It's like an era of association with certain roles. A specific part like Spock or a kind of part like Siler is coming to an end. I think it's safe to say this will be the last serial killer I'll be playing for the foreseeable future." And somehow people twisted that to be him saying that Spock is the sort of character he won't be playing for the foreseeable future.
Right. And I think he was just using Spock as an example because so many people know that he is playing Spock right now and it's such an iconic character. But I think all he was saying here is pretty much, I don't want to play a serial killer on
right.
a TV show.
And unless I missed played... something. Yes.
I know. So, and it's very different. You know, he's playing Spock once every 3 or 4 years now. He played Sylar on Heroes, and then he turned around and he's playing this serial killer on American Horror Story Asylum.
Right.
You've got to get tired of playing the same type of character. And naturally, as an artist, he wants to expand and go into other areas. And I think that's all he was saying. And fans just latch onto this, and you know, some news sites will latch onto this and try to make a story out of it, where I really don't think there is any question. You don't walk away from the role of Spock, you know?
Oh, no.
Heroes is not Star Trek. Asylum is certainly not Star Trek. Sylar is not Spock. Spock is a character. If you get the role of Spock, you're never going to let that go as long as someone wants you to play Spock.
Right. And I think what he's saying is he's sort of ending this era where he's playing serial killers or bad guys and starting a career where he's doing more roles like Spock. I think he's more saying it's the start of this sort of thing. Now, this is probably going to nix those plans for Star Trek 3, where Spock becomes a serial killer after the death of Uhura at the hands of the Glamour King. So that they're going to have to start doing some changes in the script based on this. But As far as him playing Spock in general, I think we can definitely calm down.
Right, right. Now, just wait till next week when the news stories come out that this is confirmation that Star Trek Into Darkness actually is a remake of The Wrath of Khan, and Spock dies at the end of the movie.
Well, of course, yes. And, of course, he puts his Katra into Kienzer right at the end, setting up the next film. I did hear all of that was confirmed by several sites, but I think we just have to wait and see.
Well, while we're talking about the main characters in Star Trek, our next item in movie news is about Chris Pine, who apparently has started just spilling the beans on the movie, pretty much, because I've got like 18 quotes from him right here about what we're going to see in Star Trek Into Darkness.
Yeah, I mean, he says the story is going to be huge in terms of scope and scale. He says Benedict Cumberbatch is the evil bad guy. He says that he has to be earning his, he earns his captain's chair in this one. What is also, he says that Benedict Cumberbatch is an incredible talent. So we've never heard that before. Well, I know. We're just going to keep adding these to the whiteboard that's behind me.
That's right, which we have divided. One side for adjectives used to describe Benedict Cumberbatch. And the other side is our list of cosplay that we're going to be doing at Star Trek Las Vegas next summer.
Right.
but, you know, I was glad to hear that Kirk is going to earn the captain's chair in this movie, because we all felt like it was a little bit ridiculous the way that he got command of the Enterprise. So I am looking forward to seeing some kind of meteor story that shows how he truly becomes the Captain Kirk that we all know and love, and not just this, you know, young gun from the Academy who got numbtongue.
Yes. I'd kind of like to see them sort of just show the end of the last film, see them jet off, you know, go into warp, and then Admiral Pike comes out of the turbolift just laughing his head off. You really thought we were going to give you a ship? What are you kidding? Get out. And just says, yes, you're an ensign. This is not happening. This was all a big practical joke.
Yeah, that would be a great way to start the film. And then he can earn. He
yes.
can earn it. You know,
and
I
then
know.
Maybe six or seven films later, he can actually get promoted to captain.
Yeah. All right. All right. So these are various quotes. Chris Pine spilling the beans on all kinds of things about the movie. And apparently, now I didn't know this. I'm glad he told us. Apparently, Greg, this movie is going to be an IMAX. Chris Pine has revealed here. Now, of course, we knew it was going to be an IMAX. I mean, this is talked about forever on here. But what we haven't talked about before on here is this new information that a 9-minute IMAX 3D Into Darkness preview is going to be coming out, and pretty much right on schedule of what you and I have been predicting for a first trailer.
I think we've pretty much covered this, right? I'm going to have to go back to the archives, or maybe some of our eagle-eyed viewers can pull it out for us. Tell me exactly when one of us predicted that there'd be a trailer on The Hobbit. But not only are we getting a trailer on regular prints, on the IMAX versions, we're getting the first 9 minutes of Star Trek Into Darkness. So if you remember the first 9 minutes of Space Adventure 2009, this may be the best part of the film being shown 5 or 6 months early.
It's very interesting to me that the studio is allowing them to release the first 9 minutes of the movie, considering that they would only greenlight a 3-second clip of Spock previously when JJ went on the Conan show.
Well, this is, you know, this is before and after. Before The Hobbit, we're going to get nothing. After The Hobbit, nonstop media blitz. It will just not end. It'll be everything. This 9 minutes will be shown on The Hobbit. You'll get the trailer. The trailer will be on every film. Chris Pine and Zachary Quinto will be on every morning show. JJ Abrams will be doing interviews with every website. We're not going to be able to get away from it. So maybe enjoy the calm for now.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to the Pepsi campaign where they have these special Star Trek Into Darkness branded bottles. And when you take the caps off, there is a word printed inside each cap. And if you collect them all, you can actually get an advanced copy of the script to Star Trek Into Darkness. The entire script will be inside bottle caps, one word at a time.
One word at a time. Yes, you collect them all, and and you'll be able to get it. Of course, not every word will be, you know, equally distributed. You know, the most spoiler words will only be on like one in, you know, 500,000 caps. So you might have to trade with your friends. It's kind of like Monopoly. Go on some forums and try to match it all up. Hopefully someone will get it worked out before the film comes out.
About halfway through the Zindi arc, Enterprise took a break from the search for the weapon and presented a story that was very traditional Star Trek. In exploring the ethical quandary of creating life simply to harvest tissue from it, Enterprise did what Star Trek does at its best. Today, we'll talk about this episode, Similitude, and to help us do that, we have two friends of the show joining us for the first time in quite a while from the Zero Room, and that's Jose Munoz. Hello, Jose.
Hello.
And we have with us an Andorian who is not Jeffrey Combs.
He is everywhere.
And that would be Doug Mirabello. Hello, Doug.
Hello. Hey.
I hope you guys have brought with you an image from Final Frontier that we can run during this podcast.
We can give you one.
We can give you one. Sure, absolutely.
I have my antenna, my Andorian antenna. They're right over here.
Nice.
Hang on.
Oh, yeah, they are. I can see them from here. Oh, wait, no, now that's all bad. He's all terribly tangled up now. That's what you get for moving.
Are they USB? Can you plug them into your computer and then control them?
That was horribly embarrassing. So the tip has broken off of one of them, but here you can't see because
I can totally see.
You're very far away.
And because on the podcast, it's a podcast. But yeah, those are my antennas.
Let me see one of those. I've never seen these before. Hold on.
Be careful with it.
Our resident Andorian. So Doug and Jose, you both worked on the Star Trek franchise for quite a while, combined through DS9, Voyager, and Enterprise, and you picked the episode today.
We were going to talk about the seventh.
Yeah.
And I had not totally remembered what the seventh was about, but I remembered that I didn't enjoy it.
Really?
And I also wasn't there for that. I also wasn't there for that episode, and so I felt like we should at least talk about one.
That you were actually there for?
Right, so Doug, you were with Enterprise for how long?
I came in at the end of season two. I think Regeneration was my first episode, or maybe the one before it. And then I was there till the end.
Okay.
I was a PA for season two and season three, and then I was Rick Berman's assistant for season four.
Okay.
So, I mean, and I was doing more than just answering his phone. I was helping with a bunch of stuff, but yeah. So I was there for the whole end of it.
The bitter, bitter end.
So you were there when they got the phone call that it's all over.
Yes. Yes.
Oh man.
Yeah.
That's rough.
And then you'll notice that I refused when we were talking about which episodes to talk about. I was like, I will not talk about the finale.
No, you can't.
Yes.
I will not do that.
No, you can't.
We did the finale, and now I never have to watch the finale ever again.
I think I don't want to talk about it.
You just brought it up.
I know.
I remember watching the finale and going, well, it's not a finale to Enterprise.
It's a finale to their era
of Star Trek.
Yes. And as that, I don't want to talk about it. Similitude.
No, let's not.
Right.
So I picked Similitude because so when I was there, we would my PA partner and I would sit in the production office, and we would get the we were like the first people to get the scripts once they came out of the writer's room, and so I would anxiously read the scripts because I'm a huge Star Trek fan and I'm working on Star Trek, and inevitably it would be like, oh, this is another stellarly mediocre episode of Enterprise that we've signed up for. Only this time, I was actually interested because it was this new guy, Manny Cotto, who was coming in. He was a co-executive producer, which is a pretty big deal. And so I was like, oh, this might be interesting because it's a new guy. And I remember reading the script and being like, oh my God, this is actually really good. And it kind of signaled a change in, because Manny would take over eventually, it kind of signaled the change in the series. I think it's kind of the first point. It's interesting because looking back at the episode guide, it was Twilight and then North Star and then this. And all three were written by Star Trek fans because David Goodman wrote North Star. He's mm-hmm. a huge Star Trek fan. He's a huge original series fan, which shows in North Star because it's a very original series episode. They're on the fucking in the Wild West. Twilight, which was written by Mike Sussman, who's another huge Star Trek fan. And then Similitude. Manny's also a big fan. And the three of them, to me at least, the three of those episodes are some of the better episodes that we ever did. So it's kind of an interesting era, phase for that show.
It is. I might disagree with you about North Star, but we can talk about that at another time.
Well, it had balls. You got to admit that episode had some balls.
Right.
No,
it was in
the wild. They were in the Wild West.
He's not.
It was the Wild West. I think my issue is it's in the Expanse, and why are there human settlement? But anyway,
okay.
I wanted to ask you: was this Manny bringing this concept to the show? Was this sort of in the rundown of episodes we should get to in the season? Where did the episode come from what you know?
I don't completely know the origins because I was. I would occasionally get to see a rundown of like log lines for upcoming episodes, but usually I didn't know anything about what was happening until the script. From what I understand, this was Manny's idea. Like he came in, he got to write whatever he wanted to write essentially, and this is what he wrote.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it's so many different episodes at once.
Yes.
Because it's a oh my God, the Expanse is weird episode. It's a what's the moral implications of blank episode? It's a shipper episode for Trip and T'Pol.
Thank God.
And it's Captain dealing with all sorts of stuff episode. And I'm sure there's more things you can think of.
Right, but
it's not a one note episode. It hits so many different things at the same time.
Well, and that's the best kind of sort of writing in general. I mean, the reason why weird stuff happens in the Expanse is because you got to have something to cut to. You need a B story because it can't all be about, you know, what's happening to Trip. And right. So you have the A line, which is, you know, saving Trip's life. You have the B story, which is, you know, sort of the interpersonal, you know, relationship stuff between Trip and T'Pol. And then you have the sort of ticking clock threat, which is these, you know, magnetic pieces of rock, space rock that are sticking to the hull of the Enterprise. So, you know, it's all working on all kinds of different levels. And that's sort of the best writing in general is when you can take what's given to you, and we'll talk about this more because I've already heard Doug talk about this, is that, you know, if you can take, well, okay, we're in this weird place, so we need a ticking clock, so let's just make it about the weird place. And then you have you're already moving into this emotional connection between Trip and T'Pol, so let's make that play against the A story, which is what do you do with this created clone semi-human life form thing that is so much like us that, you know, I mean, it all those elements are working sort of in clockwork together to make a good episode. That's the best writing.
Yeah,
that's the thing, is they do work together in this case. Sometimes the episode's all over the place because they're trying to do too many things, but I think here Manny did a very good job of making it.
I'm not a huge Enterprise fan. But that said, this I like this episode, and I don't think there was a point in time where I was like, "Oh, Beetle Bull," you know, just, you know, that's just crap. You know, I was engaged the whole time I was watching it. You know, I didn't feel like they copped out too many times. They made hard decisions. They took Archer to a place where I'd never seen him before, you know, which was interesting. And so all those things like really worked. It felt not real, you know, it felt real-ish for Star Trek, but it also, right. but it had emotion in the right place. And at no point in time was I like, oh, well, this is just some, you know, they're just flipping the switch to make the thing go around so that this other thing happens. You know, none of those things happened. You
the
know?
Thing that I really, right. the thing that I remember thinking at the time was, you know, to me, science fiction always works best when it's used to tell stories that you couldn't do in any other medium than science fiction. And throughout most of Enterprise, we didn't really do that. Exactly. Like it was, you know, they would tell some good stories, but they were mostly like, oh, we have to stop this alien from doing this or whatever. Whereas in this case, they actually used, and it's a bottle show, which adds to the fact that like, wow, they actually did a good job with this. But they actually used science fiction and this co-cloning thing to tell a story that you couldn't otherwise tell, which I think is something that TOS did a lot. And also it's a kind of a comment on cloning, which is also very TOS. I like to think of it as Manny is a huge Star Trek fan. And for him to get the job on Enterprise must have been a pretty, I mean, it was not doing well at the time. But for him, I mean, that's got to be a pretty awesome thing, right? I mean, imagine being like, oh, yeah, we're going to put you in charge of Enterprise. So this is like the episode that like he had to sit down and be like, this is my first, this I'm writing an episode of Star Trek.
Right.
What do I do? And this is what he came up with. And I think that kind of shows, you know?
I like that it plays off of Enterprise's strengths. For one thing, this, what is it called, Chris? The creature that he uses?
Oh, it's a Lycerian desert larvae.
Right, exactly. I cannot imagine Beverly having that in a cabinet somewhere.
No, because that was always Phlox's deal, was he had these weird things.
And you would never find that on Voyager because Neelix would have cooked it.
Exactly. The Lycerian souffle in the morning. But yeah, so it draws on that. It draws on the fact that they have put them in the expanse and they can't just get home.
Yep.
And it draws on, I mean, just draws on these things that are Enterprise specific. And it makes you feel like, yes, this isn't just a recycled Next Gen or recycled Voyager script. We're actually doing something kind of new with the show.
Well, if I just say something there too. So sometimes with this episode, I feel like it's a little bit like Second Chances because you have Riker duplicated. It's a little bit like Tuvix where you've got this Neelix and Tuvok thing.
but come on.
What I like about similitude is that in the other ones, so Thomas Riker and William Riker, they kind of go on, they live their own lives, they just keep going. And then you've got Tuvix where basically Janeway makes the decision for this new being that he has to sacrifice himself. But in this case, Trip or Sim, in the case, well, Sim at the end, actually, you know, he has kind of reconciled himself that he only has a few days left. But then he changes, and it's actually not Archer who makes the decision here. It is actually Sim. And I thought that was, it was nice to see Star Trek handle it in that way for a change.
Yes, although if there had been a happy planet nearby that he could have lived on, he might have just left in the shuttle pod.
Yeah, because that's what he says. He's like, I don't really know where to go. You bring up two other episodes. When I was watching this, I was more reminded of, and not that this is a good episode, but and I can't remember the name of it, but it's the episode where Troy has the baby, grows up really fast.
Yeah,
and
that's true.
And it felt like when I was watching this that it touched on some of like the Next Gen TOS sort of style stuff where you're really hitting an issue kind of head on, not in a head on, but you're talking about life and what life means and when is it science and when is it life. It touches a little bit on stuff from Measure of a Man. It asks a lot of those same questions about what is sentient life and what freedom and rights does it have. And I love that. I love that it was, you know, touching on, you know, if Picard had been on the ship, you know, there would have been a trial. You know what I mean? It's like, I love that idea of it because it reminded me of old school Star Trek and some of the best Next Gen episodes where it was doing kind of what Star Trek does best, which is it does adventure and sci-fi, you know, well, but what it does best is sort of talk about the human condition. And this is one of those episodes where it directly talks about what it is to be alive and human and sentient and all of those things. And
I mean, essentially they're creating body parts to be taken. Like this is kind of on its surface something I don't think most of the captains would do. Right. I don't think Picard would even consider cloning body parts or cloning making a person just to take the body parts, whether he's going to be alive for 15 days or not. I mean, the moral quandary of that, I just wanted to know what you guys thought just on the surface. Okay, either he's going to die or we create a being to harvest the organs from.
Right. And how
do you feel about Archer's decision to create it?
I think that's what he had to do. And we talked about this earlier, is that if they weren't in the expanse, if they were able to get home in a day or whatever, then there's no way that he would have done it. But it's stubbly 5 o'clock shadow Archer, and he's got a mission, and he needs to save the entire Earth. And so it's a tough decision. And it's just like when he locks that dude in the airlock and almost kills him in whatever the hell episode that was.
I don't think that was awesome.
Yeah, I don't think he would have done it otherwise, but you... And there's even that moment where he essentially says that, and you can tell it's a difficult decision. But the fact that it's only going to live for 15 days, like that, you could tell that all that stuff was put in the script to make it an easier decision, and then it has to be undone later, which if I have one complaint about the episode, it's that it undoes that stuff very quickly. Like the 15 day, the, oh my God, this operation is actually going to kill him, when I thought it was going to let him live. And the, oh, maybe we can have him live longer than 15 days, just kind of comes out and you're like, oh, really? And like, they're just undoing these things that they had to do before. But overall, I think it was an interesting place to put Archer in. And yeah, I agree. No one else would have. I don't think any of the other captains.
Well, I mean, Janeway could have been put in a similar situation. I mean, they're both in the, it's Enterprise takes a lot of like, or tries to, again, and sort of comes up short, do what Voyager tries to do and also comes up short, is to separate the ship from Starfleet, you know, from resources and equipment and medical facilities and all of the comforts that, you know, TNG has and to a certain extent, the original Star Trek. And then make them kind of have to like live out there on their own, kind of be a little bit more frontier about it. And you could have put Janeway in a similar situation. And I don't know if Janeway doesn't make the same choice, put in the same spot, you know, like if it had been, it can't be Neelix, but anybody but Neelix or Kes. But you know, if it had been Tuvok or something like that, someone that she has an emotional connection to, A, and that she desperately needs on the ship because he's the smartest guy on board and he can get stuff done, then maybe she does it, you know, because they're cut off. They have no other option. And that's the position Archer's put into. And it's a what do you call it? It's a Spock conundrum. It's a, you know, the good of the many outweigh the good of the one. It's like, well, if I got to sacrifice this guy, I'm going to do it. I'm morally sort of lesser for doing it, but I'm doing it because I'm trying to serve a higher purpose. And
you kind of remind me when you bring up Spock. I mean, we just did Search for Spock last week, and this is kind of a similar situation in which you're creating a brand new version of your crew member who's died. They end up not going in the same direction because for some reason, I guess they can't get Sim, make Sim live a normal life. I never was quite solid on that, but they floated the idea for a moment in the episode that Sim would just be Trip.
Yeah, there's a moment where they're like, you can try this experimental enzyme or something along those lines, and it might stabilize my rapid aging. And Phlox is like, well, there's almost no chance that that will work.
Right.
He's like, but you got to try. And that's kind of what I liked about the episode was there's a thing where Sim is at the beginning, once Archer kind of tells him what's going on, he's resigned to it. He's like, okay, you know, I'm going to die and stuff like that. But then I believe I have my chronology right. It's after he sort of has these feelings for T'Pol that, mm-hmm. he comes in and he's like, you got to try this. I don't want to die. You know,
because he starts flirting with T'Pol when he's
young,
the younger, the one just before actual Connor Trinneer.
Yeah.
And then when he's Connor Trinneer, he says he mentions the enzyme. So yeah, you're right.
Yeah, it's
the teenage Trip is going to have a thing for T'Pol because T'Pol's hot. And then as he gets older, I think he starts realizing, oh, well, I have these deep feelings that come from actual Trip.
Right, but it's not feeling. He started remembering all the events that were in the teaser.
Yeah. But it's, it's not only that to me. It's going through a life. It's going through it's going through a life, and the closer you get to your end, the more you sort of cherish the life that you have. So when
that's
you're
true.
And especially, and then you've been told that you're going to live, and there's all of those things that happen, but it's also about the course of a life, I think. And when you start sort of looking at your own mortality and you can see literally, you know, the ticking of the clock, you know, he wants to live. And that's a very emotional moment. And I think and not only that, but then it proves to be an even a great dramatic moment for Archer when they have that confrontation. I think it's in Trip's quarters. And he's like, you know, how long have you been here? How long? You're not Trip. And, you know, and he's like, are you going to order me? And, you know, you're going to make me? You're going to get some guards down here to take me down and strap me down to a bio bed? And Archer's like, if you make me,
he says to Archer, you're not a murderer. And Archer says, don't make me one.
Yeah, don't make me one. Which is a great line. I mean, it's all of that stuff. And you can see how Archer's being pushed to a place where I'd never seen him before. And not that I'm a huge sort of, I have this volume of knowledge of Enterprise episodes, but I'd never seen him kind of go there and be that. Dark isn't the right word, but there's a desperation to him.
There's desperation. Like, first and second season Archer would have never made this decision.
No.
But this episode it's 10 episodes into the whole Zindi arc. I guess 11 if you count the end of the second season.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And at this point, you do start to feel this desperation on the part of Archer. And whether you like the Zindi arc or not, it definitely changed the character of Archer.
Yes.
And it took him from this kind of wide-eyed explorer who was really naive to...
Yeah, I was going to use the word bland, but yes, naive is a better way to put it. It did give him kind of... It gave him an edge that he didn't really have before, which I think was needed.
I wouldn't have called him bland or naive. I would just have called him stereotypical. We'd seen that before.
Right.
Because this was
200, how many hundreds of episodes into Star Trek?
But we'd seen like the lantern jawed, wide eyed explorer captain, you know, to a certain extent that didn't have to make hard decisions, you know, and now he was having to make those harder choices.
He doesn't have the laws to follow or to not follow. He's making it up as he goes along. He doesn't have the prime directive. At some point they mention, you know, this cloning is illegal on such and such a planet. He says, well, we're not on that planet.
Yeah.
And the Federation has no laws about this. So it's another example of him having to kind of make it up as he goes along. You know, I'm sure somebody could have quoted a Starfleet regulation to Picard and basically say, no, sorry, that's simply not an option.
And you also have Archer in a position with the Zindi arc, where he, you know, it's the fate of the Earth in the balance.
Yeah.
If he succeeds in this mission, then the Earth won't be destroyed. And if he doesn't, then billions of people are going to die. Which, like the Zindi arc or not, it's an interesting place to put him.
Right.
Yeah. Now, I don't know quite how needed Trip is to defeat the Zindi. I mean, he's important. He's a great engineer. But I'm not sure the Zindi arc hangs in the balance as much as it is Trip's life.
It's Trip's life, and I also think this is where, you know, the fact that it's a good script comes in. The B story with the magnetic particles, they need Trip to get out of that too. I mean, and then it turns out that they really did, because Sim's the one who comes up with the solution. But they probably could.
Well, but it's in the situation where you're like, and, you know, correct me if I'm not getting my Enterprise lore correct, but it feels like the crew of Enterprise, however we may feel about them as characters in the long run, but the idea of them was that they were not only the best of the best, but they were unique at their talent. They were, you know,
that's true,
because this was the first sort of deep space, you know, big time ship, you know, that was going out there. And, you know, I got to think, if you're Archer, you know, Trip's not just an engineer. You know, for us, maybe as audience members, there's Geordi and Scotty and, you know, all these other characters. But for Archer, he is the engineer. He is the only guy on his ship that knows how to make Enterprise work and make it work well and do the things and do the magic that it needs to do. And if Archer feels like, you know, my engineer is the only guy that's going to get us through this mission, then my engineer is the only one that's going to get us through this mission. He's got to live at all costs. And because some of the other characters on Enterprise were sort of eventually, in my opinion, sort of degraded as to their importance. I don't know. Did Mayweather ever amount to anything?
No.
He had a couple episodes. Was it really, really good in Horizon?
Hoshi? Was it Hoshi?
Hoshi was neutered after the first.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So those characters don't mean as much to the ship, but clearly guys like Trip and T'Pau, you know, like those people are what make that ship run. And, and there's no replacing them. It's not like it was TNG and, well, if Riker dies, well, you know, there's, you know, whatever the Commander Shelby can come on board and she'll be all right, you know, and, you know, we can move on. But
if Geordi dies in a freak transport accident, just get, you know, Argyle out of the Jeffries tube and he'll resume his duties.
Yeah, exactly.
If he misses one of those barrel rolls under the door.
As the
core is exploding.
The core is exploding. Yes. You know.
Excellent.
Miles O'Brien
reaches under to grab his visor and gets crushed.
O'Brien turned out to be a pretty decent engineer, so you know, he was fine.
He did.
But that's what I'm saying. Right. It's like some of those characters on Enterprise were at least from a story standpoint, irreplaceable. So I could see Archer's desperation saying, this is one of those guys I can't lose.
They've used the magic clone bean. So next time somebody's in trouble, like if Hoshi gets some terrible sickness, they can't.
I think Phlox only had one magic. I think he only had one magic bean.
Yeah, I'm going to go with that.
Yeah.
There was only one in the jar.
Yeah.
So
they really, I mean, they should have maybe put that in there, actually, just a quick line.
But that was,
you're right.
That was a really big bean because I was looking at that and thinking that's like a very really, really bean. Expensive ball of mozzarella.
And
like,
he just, really and he just stabs that thing too, like with the sensor probe.
Yeah.
He's just like,
yeah.
Like, okay.
It was very Cronenberg. It's like, it was pulsating and.
Yeah.
If that had a little more.
I thought that Billingsley did a great job of sticking that thing into that blob with a serious face because it's so ridiculous if you just watch it for what's actually happening on the screen and forget about the whole what that thing's supposed to be within the story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's weird when he pushes that thing in and like some liquid comes out.
Yep.
It was well done.
Right.
It's fairly well done. Billingsley did a good job. And I think Connor did a really good job in this episode.
I thought he did too. I thought he did a really good job of playing two different characters.
Yeah.
Which with enough subtlety that you knew that Sim wasn't him.
Yeah.
You know, again, there was a little bit of desperation and angst and confusion in that trip, in spite of having all of his memories and sort of being the same guy, than there was in the normal trip. He was a little bit more confident, a little bit more cocky, and a little bit more, you know, sure of himself, and Sim had some of those qualities, but there was almost like, I don't want to say naivete to it, but there was a vulnerability to that character that Trip doesn't have.
Yeah, and I also want to mention that we got really lucky in that LeVar Burton directed this episode, because there were, the baby doesn't count, but there was a slightly older Trip who was, I don't know, six, in that sick bay when they're reading the book.
Right.
And then there was the still older Trip who was still a kid, and it was the same kid from the first episode of the season, right? The Zindi?
Right, yep. Yep.
And it's LeVar, so he is obviously amazing with kids since he taught us all to read. And so I remember, you know, him taking time and working with these kids and really trying to make them comfortable.
Oh, that's great.
And I think it works. I remember especially that scene in the sick bay where they're teaching the kid to read, which I think is that kid's only scene.
Yeah, I think it is too.
I never made that connection to the reading, but yeah, that's absolutely now I'm thinking of reading Rainbow.
Yeah.
And I will next time I watch that scene. I did feel like the accents could have been a little bit better matched.
Yeah.
I thought
that's tough for kids.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's tough in general. It's you know, it's an established character. And I think unless you're a little bit older and a little bit more experienced, you know, you just put on a Southern accent and move on, you know.
But I still kind of buy the kids. And I like that it's a way of doing flashbacks to Trip's childhood without having to actually do flashbacks.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think all the kids were fine. Like I said, I was remarkably shocked at how much I enjoyed this episode. Well, You have to understand.
I know, but
here's the thing, and this is my admission of why I'd never really glommed onto Enterprise was, when Enterprise premiered, I got in because I'd worked on the show, not on Enterprise, but because I worked on Star Trek and I still knew people there. I got invited to the premiere of the they played the premiere episode
of
Enterprise
Theater.
At the Paramount Theater.
I was there.
And so I go and it's, all kinds of people and I'm, talking to all Star Trek people and everybody's really psyched because, new series. And I go and I sit and I watch the whole thing and I come out and I turned over to a good friend of mine who, worked on the show and I said, it's the same shit. It's time travel. There's Klingons, right? It's everything about Star Trek that we've already gotten just with a different crew. And it just completely sucked the wind out of it. Cause I like Scott Bakula quite a bit and I thought he did a fine job, but it was just like, there was nothing new to it for me. And it turned into one of those things where I didn't watch Enterprise unless it was just kind of on. Yeah, they had phasers. Like I was like, oh my god, those guns are great, and then they were gone.
I think Broken Bow is a fantastic pilot. I think it's one of the better Star Trek pilots.
I don't disagree with you. I'm just saying,
it's the best Star Trek pilot. But yeah, you're right. They don't stay in that mode long enough. I was talking with Brandon Braga on Twitter, and he was talking about how they want to make the whole first season be set on Earth, and have Archer finding his crew. Mm-hmm. And yet, I think that would have been a lot better because, as you say, they rush into it, and it's already Star Trek by the end of Broken Bow.
Too quickly they get there, and it's the same. It was the same problem that Voyager had. It's they were willing to take that narrative risk of not giving the audience exactly what they wanted, but yet what the audience wants is good drama, right? You'll get to the phaser eventually. You'll get to the transporter eventually. What we want is good drama to get there. And if you change the perspective a little bit, you can still give them good drama. It's the same problem with Voyager. Voyager was stuck out in the middle of nowhere for 7 years or whatever, and the ship was still perfect every episode, and there never seemed to be consequences, and there was no follow through from episode to episode. And then all of a sudden, Year of Hell comes along, and you're just like, oh my god, this is how the whole show should be. And it never got there because it was hard. I understand that there's pressure to give the audience what you think they want, but at the same time, what the audience wants is good drama, and that always comes. The audience will get over the superficial stuff if they get good drama.
Yeah, Enterprise felt like UPN was always chasing the ratings and adjusting to, like you say, what they think the audience wants. And
yes, there was
that Dave Rossi thing about the boy band. You remember that? I think we said that last time.
Yes, yeah. Oh, I've heard about this. Yeah,
I think. Yeah, you mentioned that on the Zero Room. Actually, I think.
Did we? Okay. Yeah.
Should we tell the story again?
Tell that story.
So there was the there was the mess hall on Enterprise, and at one point, an executive from UPN was like, they have this room where they all eat. And maybe we could put a little stage in there and we could get bands in, like the bands that the kids like. They could come in and they could play. And Rick and Brandon were just like, have you ever seen the show? It takes place in the future. And they're on a spaceship. I don't know how the band... But
it's holographic One Direction.
Yes.
Yes.
It's like it's a recording from the 21st century.
Yeah. And really, like, the relationship with UPN was very interesting because they were... It was unique in the fact that UPN was not allowed to give them any notes on the scripts, which is absolutely unheard of. So the scripts were not touched at all. But like you said, when the ratings aren't good, they come in and they suggest certain things, and you are behooven to follow those things because they are your network.
Right. So. Yeah. So, Doug, can you speak to the Trip and T'Pol love story that comes out of nowhere? Like it always felt like they were going somewhere with Archer and T'Pol.
Yeah.
But then all of a sudden Trip is heartbroken over his sister and can't sleep, so we start the blah.
Dude, I had completely...
Was that a network note? What was it?
Again, I don't totally know because I wasn't in the big office at that point. I was in the production office, and so we're not told these things. But I had forgotten about the neuropressure, and then that scene comes on. It's like the second scene after. It's maybe even the first scene after the cold open.
Yeah.
No, the cold open.
Oh, the cold open.
It's
yeah.
a great cold open where he's given the thing, and then you're like, they show you each crew member, and you're like, he's not dead. He's not dead.
It's the cause and effect.
It's like, oh my God, someone's dead.
Yeah.
And then they got into that neuropressure scene, and I was like, oh my God, I totally blocked this out because it was just so terrible. And, you know, I think it's just like the decontamination chamber. We're on UPN, and we're a weird show for UPN because it's science fiction. And so we want to get in sexy people rubbing each other's feet. I don't know. So I don't know if it came from... My guess would be that the network was probably pushing for some kind of a romance. And then that was the most logical one just because they're both attractive and...
But Star Trek's never shied away. Well, original series certainly did. But from next gen forward, there was always some sort of romantic entanglement within the crew.
But I feel like it was never as obvious as the Trip and T'Pol thing was.
I don't know if I entirely agree with that, but okay. I mean, Bashir lusting after Jadzia for however
he's
many...
He's badass. He's Bashir.
I understand that he's... Okay. I'm with you. I'm just saying. But, I mean, his chasing, you know, Dax for however many seasons that was, and it was a long time, you know, of him pining over her. That went a long way. And on Voyager, I mean, you had the Kes and Neelix thing right away because that was built in. But then Seven of Nine eventually got like involved with somebody, right?
Seven of Nine, Chakotay came out of nowhere, holographic love affair, I guess, between them. But the Paris Bellana relationship was very organic, very well done throughout the course of the show.
Exactly. So that's my point. I mean, I don't think Star Trek's ever shied away from having. You know, not ever, but like I said, since in the TNG era, shied away from having romance on board.
But it's always been more graceful than they have to give each other massage sessions.
Well,
I can't sleep.
I can imagine being in the room going, well, how do we put these two together? What's the situation we're going to put them into where they have to be in close proximity to each other? Where it's sexually suggestive? She's a Vulcan, so it's not like she can. You know what I mean? It's not like we don't break that right away, right? We don't want to break the no emotion, no.
Oh, they've already fucked that up by this point.
But though. I'm just saying. But you don't want to break. You don't want to completely shoot that out the window. So you got to come up with something.
There's better ways than this.
I completely agree. I'm just saying. I'm trying to give them a little slack.
Okay,
help me out.
I think the issue is the cast was so small at this point. Like they started with. Sure, a whole bridge crew, but then they sort of stopped paying attention to Travis, stopped paying attention to Hoshi, kind of stopped paying attention to Reed. And it was down to the three of them, and we probably can't have the captain involved with anybody. And
we weren't going to have Trip and Archer in a relationship.
And right? As much as some people would like, that wasn't going to happen. Yes. And I think that's the issue. The one that I loved was, and I always forget her name, but the assistant who comes in to help out Phlox and... That lovely character from the first season.
Yeah.
That was working really well, and they dropped it when they went to the second season. I felt like they needed to do that. Like, bring in a character we haven't seen before, have Trip have a relationship with her.
Bring in a new Judd. A new Judd sister.
A new Judd
exactly.
sister.
Yeah.
Ensign Leffler, the sweetheart of many a young nerd.
That's right.
I agree that it at least in that episode it isn't very gracefully done at the beginning, but nonetheless, what it does dramatically from the show is great, right? It allows them it gets to have that great moment with Sim where he's like, so how do you feel about Trip, and how do you know what if those feelings were more than that, and you know it's. I love the awkwardness of that
the
scene.
The way that they deal with the way that they deal with the Trip and T'Pol relationship in this episode is great because you have Trip but not Trip facing his death and going to her and telling her how he feels, which is really also how real Trip feels. And they have that kiss because she knows it's really good because
and she's able to open up and then you can break that moment.
Because you leave them in a place where now T'Pol knows and has kissed him.
Exactly.
And when Trip wakes up from his coma, he doesn't know what happened. And so it furthers the awkward relationship in as good a way as I think he he could have.
No, that's the thing. Yeah.
It reminds me actually of DS9, A Children of Time, but done way better.
Yes.
Because in that one, Odo merges, like, future, past future Odo merges with our Odo and gives him all the memories. So then things are just weird. Whereas in this one, it's, yeah, like you say, T'Pol knows. And right. She was sort of able to reveal her feelings to the audience and to herself.
And in a way, to Trip. That's the best part, is that it's not that she's, right. Dear Diary, Trip is really handsome. It's, you know, it's not that moment. And it's not that she's telling a girlfriend or she overhears Trip. She gets to actually experience the full, like, moment, you know, without any of the repercussions, which is amazing.
And we could have had a scene with T'Pol and Hoshi in the workout session talking about guys. I probably wouldn't have complained.
Or in the decon chamber, rubbing each other down with KY jelly and glitter.
See, that's exactly the thing. You know, when Broken Bow came out, they had the whole rub down and the decontamination.
Oh, that's so terrible.
And it was just so obviously put in there to sex up the show. I mean, it didn't bother me. Like, I wasn't offended by it or anything, but I was looking at it like, you know, this is completely unnecessary for the story. They're just trying to make the show more racy. But
if they had shot it differently, it would have changed the way that was perceived. It was just the way it was shot.
But the scene in this episode is so overtly sexual. I was watching it. I'm like, okay, could you do anything else to make this more sexual without actually getting them undressed?
There's that moment where she's straddling his face and leans over him. And you're like, oh. And then you imagine like LeVar Burton behind the camera telling them to do that. And it's even creepier.
Lean more. just like Leah Brahms did. No?
Yeah, it's like there's ways to suggest that sexual... like tension without it being so like, you know, and now downward dog, and you just, you know, and no, just there's no need for that.
But the thing for me with this one though is that I thought, like you said, it did serve a purpose, because without the scene at the beginning, all the stuff that happens at the end wouldn't work quite as well. This actually did set up the ending of the episode. So while you're watching it and you think that, why are they doing this at the beginning? When you get to the end, you're like, okay, now... yes, I understand why the scene was necessary. So it's one case where having Enterprise's underwear shots actually worked for the story.
I almost wish that there had been a coda where with T'Pol and Sim, not even T'Pol and Trip, but T'Pol and Sim after he died or something like that. Like I wanted because there's no closure to that, right? That's left for next episode. Right, there's no closure to that moment, and I almost wanted a little something to wrap that up with at the end, where either a sideward glance at Trip or a look at Sim or a moment where they're alone, you know, or whatever, or something, you know, not to get creepy. I'm just saying, you know, just something to wrap that up with, because in her arc in that episode, and probably in the relationship and of her character, this is really the first time that she's, you know, given of herself in a physical way to someone. And it was, you know, this sort of half clone, half man thing. And that's gotta be that to me feels like a huge emotional moment that we never paid off on because it's Enterprise. But I don't know if future episodes ever like come back to that moment or touch on that.
I don't think they ever directly mention this episode, which is weird because now that you mention it also would have been cool to have even 30 seconds with real Trip.
Right.
Once he's back
and
Archer's like, hey, while you were gone, we cloned you, and there was a dude who looked just like you and had all your memories and was essentially you. He made out with T'Pol, and then we pulled out a piece of his brain, and now you're alive. Like, that would have been an interesting scene to get his reaction.
Yeah, pretty much all we get is that we get the teaser again, only with a shot of a very confused Condor Trinneer.
He's like, I'm looking at myself here. It's
what's
totally
going
weird.
On? Where am I? Is this a dream? there's absolutely no, without a doubt. I wanted the best stand-in
actor I've ever seen.
It's, and I guess it's the testament to how good this episode is in the fact that I haven't watched a lot of Enterprise and I don't have any sort of big emotional attachment to any of the characters. that I did get emotionally attached to some of the stuff that was going on. And I wanted to know more. Like, I want the next episode now to be all about, you know, how does, you know, to Paul deal with sort of...
Yeah, it's not.
Yeah, no, I understand. Like, that shit's not going to happen.
The next episode is basically an episode of Fringe.
Hey, Fringe is a good show. But my point is that it made me want them to take the moments that had happened here and take them a little bit further. And part of that is because, you know, we're what? How far removed are we from this episode? 8 years? 7 years?
2004 or five?
Yeah, eight years.
Four,
this was 2003, actually. So
was it?
This would be nine years. Yeah. November 19th, 2003, actually.
There you go. So
yeah, we're exactly
so nine years. So 9 years removed from this. And since that, you know, we've gotten Lost. And Lost is, you know, the rebirth of sort of, you know, arc storytelling and, trying to, you know, every episode builds on what's come before it. And I watch that and I'm like, oh, that's awesome. Like, so that's going to carry in the next episode, right? No, I know in my heart that's not the case, because Enterprise and all the Star Trek shows are basically, they're all episodic for the most part, with small threads that go through. But, you know, but the emotions and the moments that happen in previous episodes don't build and build and build and then, you know, sort of arc at the end. It is what it is. But like I said, testament to what a good episode is, because it made me want that from those characters. People that I don't normally care that much about.
Yeah, that is true.
We talked a bit about the Zindi arc and, of course, how it changed Archer here. Now, in the other side of the room...
The other side of the room.
We were talking a little bit about the fact that this is sort of a non-Zindi episode that... Well, not sort of. It is a non-Zindi episode in the middle of the Zindi storyline, and that we had things like North Star as well. I felt that this did a good job, though, of tying in to the Zindi arc itself. It gave you that break from this constant, you know, search for the weapon.
Right.
But without the Zindi arc, you know, the whole ethical quandary that Archer finds himself in here wouldn't happen. And we've actually touched on this quite a bit in the discussion. I guess another point here that I want to get your thoughts on is, how did you feel about the Zindi arc itself, and how do you feel about taking a break in the middle of it? Like, you feel like the story needs that break that we got here, and actually return to a little more focus on the characters?
I think that the episode does a great job of using the situation that they're in without furthering the Zindi, you know, plot line at all, but using the fact that they're on this mission, they're away from home, and Archer is so intent on completing his mission that he refuses to shave. It takes that and it uses them. It puts the characters in a situation that otherwise they would never be in. So that's interesting. Overall, look, I think especially at the time when we knew that they were going to do a season that was serialized, we were totally excited about that, because we, like you said, we hadn't had Lost yet. We had had DS9 and Voyager. Voyager, not the greatest. DS9 at its best when it started doing serialized storytelling. And so it was like, okay, we're going to actually do a serialized story on Enterprise. And it was
DS9's serialized storytelling was almost in spite of itself. Like, it was,
yes.
Mm-hmm. It was a fight to make that happen.
Yeah. And so, you know, it was exciting to know we were going to do that. The attack was kind of weird. It was a weird way to go about it, but, it was certainly, I mean, you guys seemed to enjoy the first and second seasons more than I did, but it was certainly something that was going to stir the show up and give it a little bit more purpose. And apart from, you know, the narrative or whatever, the ratings weren't great. So they had to do something to try to kick it into gear. And they decided to up the stakes and tell a serialized story. So
I guess I feel like, because they tied it in with the time travel and because it was an alien we'd never heard of, I felt like, I don't see how this is going to raise ratings. Yeah. Like, you have people not watching the show. What are they going to hear? Okay, there was an attack on Earth. Okay, that's going to ring some 9/11 bells in my head, maybe. But it's not really going to make me watch the sci-fi show that I wasn't watching before. Whereas if they'd done something really crazy, like move it to the future and have the Romulan War start, like, that might have gotten people involved.
If this had been the Romulan War instead of the Zindi, because the problem with the Zindi is that you're bringing in
this entire race that we've never ever heard of before into what's supposed to be a prequel show. Now, the Romulan War would have been something people would have latched onto and could have been serialized.
I will make the argument that I'll play devil's advocate here, not knowing too much about the Zindi, but
I'm going to agree with what you're about to say.
Yeah.
But go on.
I will play devil's advocate and say that it would be better to do it with somebody that you don't know. And why pick the Zindi over the Romulans, for example, is because let's say that you were even remotely interested in sampling Enterprise because you, I don't know why, just because you want to sample it, right? The Romulans already come with baggage, right? They're a known entity, right? Fans want the Romulans because we know them. We know their background. We know their history. We know where they come from. So now we want to see that. We want to prequelize it, right? But
we need more than fans to watch the show for the ratings to go up.
Exactly. So if we introduce a new villain in a new situation, and basically what I'm hearing is, and not having watched it, I'm just sort of supposing here that it's almost like the start of a new show is the Zindi thing, right? It's a new threat. It's a new villain that the audience doesn't know. So if you watch that episode from, you know, the moment it happened, then you're in on the ground floor of a whole new story of all kinds of new people. And you don't have to have previous knowledge of who the Romulans are or whoever it was. You know, that was, again, part of my problem with Enterprise was, I think by episode 3, we met Ferengi, right? Yeah, episode 3 or 4 or something like that?
Not 3, but it was early on.
It was really, really early. So it was like one of those things where it was like, you're just, it's the same things I've already seen. Like, show me something new. And whether or not the Zindi is a threat or as a race or whatever were a success or not, I think the idea from a storytelling standpoint is, if we want to bring in new people, then we got to make it as accessible as humanly possible. And you see this in comic books a lot with reboots and, you know, relaunches and stuff like that. It's, wait, where's Lex Luthor? Now we don't want to deal with that yet. We're going to introduce a generic threat. And I know the fans aren't going to like it, but new readers don't have to have any baggage or knowledge to enjoy it. They can just sort of enjoy it as the fans do, because they're getting the same information that fans do. And then it's incumbent upon the writing staff and the producers and everything to make that all engaging and exciting, which apparently they did a mediocre job of. But the point is that if it's a new threat, then everybody can be on the same page and there's not the I know more than you do kind of thing. Do you agree with that, Doug?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, there you go.
Yeah, at that point we needed more. If all the Star Trek fans watched the show, the numbers weren't going to be good enough to make it a success. And so you needed to do something to try to get those people who, like, when, you know, when I was a kid and I was watching TNG, I could talk about that show with my friends' parents, you know,
right,
who don't care about science fiction, but they were watching Star Trek because it was cool. And those people stopped, and you needed to try to get those people back.
Right. And I think if you look at the history of Next Gen, they didn't lean too hard on the old stuff. I mean, they didn't lean too hard on having a Romulan. I mean, it was like until end of season one when we saw, no, end of season two, we saw Romulan for the first time in TNG, right?
It was right at the end of season one. Yeah, towards the end of season one. They were going to do the Borg and they couldn't pull that off yet. Mm. So they brought
in
the Romulans.
Okay, yeah. And then, but we never really saw, there wasn't too much Romulan stuff. They introduced the Cardassians and the Borg and the Ferengi. Like, we got like a ton of new villains, right? New bad guys, new races, new stuff. They leaned so little on Romulans, and it is on the stuff that we already knew. Except for the Klingons, but even then it was just Worf on the ship. And it took a while for us to get into the Klingon homeworld and all of that stuff. And that's the beauty of it all, is like, don't reintroduce the same stuff. Voyager did a pretty good job of that as well, because they were obviously in, you know, the Delta Quadrant and they couldn't have the same stuff. They dipped their toe in the Borg because everybody has to have
needed a ratings boost.
Exactly, because everybody, you know, you gotta taste the good crack, and that's the Borg. But
I think the fourth season of Enterprise is an interesting thing to think about in this capacity, because
the fourth season of Enterprise is fan service.
Right. The fourth season of Enterprise, they were like, okay, whatever. Manny was in charge. He was a huge Star Trek fan. It was like, all right, let's go back. Let's do all these stories that the fans really want to see. And the fact that if you were a regular person and you tuned into Enterprise in season 4,
oh, you were lost.
You didn't know what the fuck was going on. You're like, is that Data? Like, I don't get it. So I think that's a case. That's a case where they actually did kind of think about, okay, what would the fans like to see? And although I think it's awesome,
I was going to say, and I'm sure that if you ask most fans, the fourth season of Enterprise is probably the best season of Enterprise. Correct.
Right.
Right. And the reason
for it didn't raise the ratings enough to get a fifth.
No, 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 no. Because by that point, not only
well,
that,
nothing was going to do that.
And not only that, but at that point in time, you really are just like you're just servicing the fans, and you're not going to bring anybody new into the tent at that point in time. Most of those episodes, and I did see more of season four than I saw of anything else, were like, okay, this might be a good story, but you're going to get a lot more out of it if you know who Nguyen Sung is, if you know what the Mirror Universe is.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to, you know, those two Mirror Universe episodes were awesome.
Awesome.
Were absolutely
but if you
great.
Were a regular person who had like watched Enterprise the week before for the first time, you're like, this is kind of cool. And then you tune in and it's all in a different universe.
And you're like, what?
Yeah, you're done.
You're done. Absolutely. No, that's no way to bring anybody into the tent. The way you do that is by making it accessible to everybody.
Yeah.
And that's hard to do.
Yeah, and I guess I've never had the experience of hopping into a show, you know, in the third season. If I hear a show's good, I'll just start it at the beginning. And I feel like the best shows are consistent throughout and tell a compelling story from beginning to end. It's really hard to reboot a show and say, we want new viewers coming in today.
Yes, and it's also interesting because nowadays...
I was going to say, you say that, but in Enterprise's time, you couldn't do that.
Right. So nowadays, if I tune into season three of Breaking Bad and I'm like, Jesus, this show is awesome. I don't really know what's going on, but it's awesome. I can then go and either buy it on DVD or get it on Netflix and I can catch up. I remember watching an episode from the second or third season of Babylon 5. And this is how old I am. And it was a really cool episode. It was this episode where they come upon this probe and they're trying to figure out what the probe is doing. And then it turns out that the probe is actually looking for intelligent life. And so if you're smart enough to hack into the probe and figure out what it's doing, it will try to destroy you. And I was like, this is cool. I want to watch Babylon 5, but I have no idea what's going on. And so I had to go on to like a CompuServe site and read episode descriptions of like 30 episodes of Babylon 5 to figure out what was going on.
I remember X-Files missing like not the pilot because I saw the pilot, but I missed like a couple of episodes. That was it. Like I missed them. They were gone forever.
Yeah, you can wait like a year and a half until they're released. That season is released on DVD.
DVD.
I mean on VHS.
VHS.
Exactly.
But and not only that, but not only and they were prohibitively expensive. And I mean, no, I absolutely agree with you that in today, it's like if you hear anything remotely good, you're like you just dive into Netflix. And I mean, that's how I watch Breaking Bad. I mainlined four seasons of Breaking Bad in like 3 weeks.
Yeah, that's why serialized storytelling works.
I'm five episodes into Newsroom today.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So that's what I'm saying. Yeah.
That's why serialized storytelling works better today. And it's why networks are allowing people to do it is because it's easier to catch up on what you missed.
Well, one of the things I think is really interesting about Enterprise season 3 and 4, and we're seeing it here in Similitude, is them just trying desperately to make a Star Trek show in the 21st century that people actually want to watch. They've got the money for the sets. They've got the money for really wonderful effects. They've got the best writers that they can get. They've got Star Trek fans running things. And they're trying a million different things. And nothing just really seems to be sticking.
Yes.
Yes. I don't know. It's just weird because I don't know if I agree with everything that you just said. I think they're trying really, really hard. I there's no doubt about that. I just don't know. I don't know. Fandom's such a tricky thing. It's like, as a Star Trek fan, I know what I want, but I don't know what fans want. I don't know if that's a weird thing to say, but but it's a tough road to hoe. I mean, fans love season 4 of Enterprise because it was speaking to them directly. But I don't know if that's the best Star Trek that you can make. I think, you know, there's something bigger than that was out there that there's something bigger about Star Trek, right? If you go back to the original series or even go to TNG, it's the original episodes that we love the most, right? For the most part. It's not necessarily the episodes that touch on lore or history or any of those things. And I mean, lore is in the bigger lore, not the other guy. but, you know, it's that kind of stuff. So I think it's really tough. I mean, fans are so finicky. We were talking about Skyfall I was talking with Skyfall with some friends, and they were talking about how much I love Daniel Craig and all of that stuff. And then I quickly went over to the internet and I punched up Daniel Craig when he was announced as James Bond and how he was absolutely vilified. And like everybody hated the idea. Oh my God, he's blonde and he's what? And who is this guy? You know, he doesn't look like James Bond. He's going to be terrible. Fans don't necessarily know shit. You know, three movies later, he's in my mind, maybe the best James Bond ever. And I think there's a huge responsibility on people that love genre television to be receptive to it, to be open to new ideas and new stuff. And the past is great. And when it's referenced, it's an important thing. But at the same time, we have to be willing in our hearts to take in new stuff and not be hypercritical of it because it doesn't fit the box that we've put this show in. Yeah. You know what I mean?
I totally agree with you on that. Absolutely.
Because we're just not going to get new stuff. Have you guys seen that Patton Oswalt thing where he's dragging like a box across the desert and he talks all about how pop culture is just like lately is just completely eating itself. You know, and it's about this, he's kind of like a post-apocalyptic nerd, like walking through and talking about, you know, how, you know, it was after the great, you know, X-Men, Star Trek, you know, X-Files crossover that everything went to hell, you know, and it's how it feels sometimes. It's like, we're so like, I don't know what this is, you know, do I want to give it my time? No, I'll just wait for the box set. No, give it your time, give it your love, give it your attention. Because that's where good shit comes out of. I mean, we all know what happened to Firefly, right? Like, nobody watched it. And now, the 10th anniversary reunion gave Sci-Fi Channel, or Science Channel, its best ratings ever by, like crazy ratings for them.
Well, it's Science
Channel. I understand. No, but I understand. But we're crazy ratings for them, and crazy ratings for a lot of cable TV, you know? And is, you know, a cultural phenomenon that everyone acknowledges is a great television show, but nobody watched it because we were afraid of something new and different. We need to give new and different a try and a chance. And you know what reminded me of that? And I was talking to Greg on Twitter was watching Blood and Chrome.
Yeah.
Right.
Which I had completely written off.
Me too.
And I watched those first two 10-minute bits and I was like, this is not half bad. Yeah, I'm going to watch the rest of this.
I felt the same way. We haven't talked about Blood and Chrome.
No, we haven't.
I agree with you.
I'm like, I'm totally going to watch the rest of this thing because this is not bad. I'm not. Yeah, the sets are cheesy and at times there's way too much lens flare to cover up, you know, their digital backgrounds.
And the whole shooting the ship with his pistol is ridiculous.
Yeah, completely ridiculous, but whatever.
Well, that was a video game, technically.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. That's true. So, but the rest of it, I was like, this is not half bad. I'm liking this. You know, this reminds me of everything I like about Battlestar Galactica.
I wouldn't go that far, but yes.
Well, it certainly felt better than those last two seasons of Battlestar. Well,
I mean, come
so,
on.
So, all right, I'm going way off. I'm going way off the reservation here. So let's bring it back.
All right. Well, why don't we bring it back to similitude? And we're around an hour, so we should wrap up here.
I have two bits of similitude trivia that I got because I looked at Memory Alpha. First, Emmy winning. For best music. And and second, the only time in all of Enterprise where the word tricorder is mentioned. Phlox says,
really?
Yeah, Phlox mentioned something about his medical tricorder. And that's the only time throughout all of Enterprise that they mention the word tricorder.
Wow, really?
And I didn't remember that from the script, but I'm convinced that it's just that it got by. That if someone had noticed it, they would have been like, oh, we don't talk about tricorders. We don't have tricorders yet. Let's get rid of it.
Right.
But I think someone missed it. I mean, obviously, a few people missed it.
Right.
But anyway, so that's my trivia for similitude. And we got some Porthos in this episode.
Yep.
So, yeah, it's all good.
Porthos is the best behaved dog, the best behaved beagle I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Especially considering Archer says he never taught him any tricks.
Yep.
That dog does exactly what you want it to do.
He's a hell of a lot better behaved than Snoopy would have been on the ship. I mean, Snoopy would have been messing around with the engines the whole time. Who knows?
He would have just slept on top of the ship.
Porthos was two dogs, Breezy and Windy. And one of the dogs, they were great dogs. One of the dogs has a black spot on his neck. And the other dog doesn't. So when it was that dog's turn, they had to paint a black spot on that dog's neck. I forget if it was, I think Breezy had the spot and Wendy didn't. But anyway, there's some behind the scenes trivia for you. There was some dude airbrushing a dog.
Nice.
They should have that as an extra when they do the Blu-ray. The Enterprise Blu-rays are coming out next year. They should have an extra behind the scenes spray painting dogs. I want that.
Definitely. Well, all in all, I think Similitude really does earn its place. You know, it what it was listed as the number top three Enterprise episode in a fan poll or something. John Billingsley said it's one of the strongest episodes in the third season. I definitely think it earns it.
Yeah, I think probably, like, I was trying to think for the podcast, like, it's one of my favorite episodes. I also love Observer Effect in season four. There's a couple others, but I would probably put it in my top three of Enterprise episodes. And Jose's only seen three episodes.
Yeah, so it's my favorite. So.
This is in your top three, Jose.
So this is my top three. It's this and the Two Mirror Universe episodes.
And the fact that it's a bottle show, and the fact that it's a new writer, and just all this stuff, and the fact that it has to fit into the Zindi arc, the fact that he pulled this off and made it one of the best episodes of the show really says something.
It also speaks to how sometimes working with limitations.
Yes.
Can yield really good art, you know. So
definitely, yeah. I think for one thing I didn't mention yet that I did want to bring up, I'll bring up in my final points here, is that this is a case where when Trip gets killed, he gets killed doing something meaningful to try to save the ship and save the crew.
Right.
Unlike the way he's killed finale, where he accidentally crossed the wires the wrong way so that Archer wouldn't be late for a meeting.
Yeah, I won't discuss the finale. I agree with you. I agree with you, though.
But yeah, I mean, here there was meaning behind it, which I thought was important.
I like to point out that it's all Trip's fault.
He had to go and try his fancy compression thing.
Yeah, and then he got himself killed.
Trip had a really bad idea.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's that weird, like, slow motion shot of him lying on the deck with, like, the glitter and the debris coming over his face.
And I was like, it was only weird in the sense that it was like, ooh, Star Trek's getting a little arty with their cinematography.
Yeah.
And, you know, but that was it.
But I really like this episode as well. What I like about Star Trek, as everyone who listens to this show knows, is I like the exploration of social issues, ethical issues, character development, getting inside the mind a bit. And this episode does it really well. And it comes in the middle of the whole Zindi arc. And I haven't actually put together a list of, you know, like my top 10 or 5 or 3 favorite Enterprise episodes. But this would, I think, definitely be in my top 5 at any rate. So I'm going to give this episode actually 9 Lycerian desert larvae.
You could replace the whole crew with those.
You could.
You could.
Wasn't there a Voyager episode where they did that?
There was a Voyager episode where we were following a Voyager that turned out to be a fake Voyager, right?
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
Was it Hell Planet?
Yes.
Or whatever?
Yes, that's it. Exactly. Yeah.
Hell Planet people.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. Yep.
It also reminded me of the fact that for half of Voyager, Kim is Kim from an alternate universe.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Which is cool.
Yep. Absolutely. Yeah.
It is pretty cool. I kind of wish I almost might like this episode better if we had gotten Clone Trip to be Trip for the rest of the show.
Yes.
That would have been a little too bold.
I was thinking about that when it happened, and I was like, really, in Star Trek, at this point, killing him was kind of the surprise. Because with Riker, you expected him to die, and then Thomas Riker sticks around, and they also swap Kims. And so at this point, it's like, we've done this kind of twice,
and we
haven't given you the ending you used to expect. So now the ending you used to expect is the unexpected ending. So it was,
and I love that they do a whole funeral for him. They do a Spock style eulogy.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Stick him in the proton torpedo tomb, which turns out this is the first time in continuity they've ever even done that.
There's some more trivia.
So I like that they don't just vaporize him and pretend it never happened.
Yeah,
just beam him out into space.
Right. Well, I like that scene too because at the beginning you really do believe that it's Trip's funeral, and then at the end when you come back and you find out it's actually Sim's funeral, not Trip's funeral.
Yes.
The way it tied together I thought was done quite
and
nicely.
Now I can go write my fan fiction where some alien finds the Sim Trip coffin and brings him back to life. And he grows a goatee and he seeks vengeance against Real Trip.
No, I figured you just have him having sex with men. Isn't that usually what happens in fan fiction? No? That's what DeviantArt has taught me.
Yes.
Is that?
Yeah. All right. Well, Doug and Jose, thanks so much for joining us again on The Ready Room. And before we go, tell everyone where they can find you guys around the internet, what you're up to.
Well, we do a show called The Zero Room. Also, you can find us at thezeroroom.net.
We'll be recording episode 209
this evening, shortly after this. Wow. And then we also have, and I'll let Doug talk about.
We have a couple years ago, if you heard us on the podcast before, you've heard us talk about this. We had pitched a animated Star Trek series called Star Trek Final Frontier, and there's a website for that series, and we just started writing new scripts for it, kind of as if like, hey, what if this had actually happened? And we're posting those now. The first story is four parts. Part two went up at the end of last week. And you can check out the pilot script, the new scripts, a bunch of concept art, and the whole story of the project on at www.startrekff.com. And there was just a big Trek movie just did an article on us at the end of last week. We've been getting some good feedback for it. So we'll be putting new scripts up and new art and all that stuff. So give it a read. It's a lot of fun. Did you have anything else to add?
No, that's it. I mean, okay. You can find, I'm on Twitter. I'm at Ringslinger. If you want to follow me or, you know, whatever, yell at us for all the things that we've said, that's fine. You can find me there. That's about it. Yeah. That's on the internet where we live.
Yeah. Thank you guys for having us on. I'm sorry that we went extra long and spiraled off into weird subtopics.
That's great.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you letting me come on and network for a little while and, rant about the world.
And you got to watch an Enterprise episode.
I did.
I didn't say this on the air, but we, after watching Similitude, Jose sent me an IM and he was like, what is this mission Archer keeps talking about and why isn't he shaving? And I had to explain that the Zindi were attacking Earth.
I understood that there was a mission and that it was really important. I just wanted to know why it was really important.
No, I understand. I don't blame you for not watching the show. I mean, really. So
I just had to know why it was really important. And I assumed it would tie into why was, Scott Bakula not shaved.
I will make a list of other good Enterprise episodes.
Will you? Because they're all on Netflix.
If you would like to watch
them. They're all on Netflix. So I can totally watch that stuff.
I will do that. Yeah.
We've spent a lot of time on the show talking about the ups and downs of Enterprise, our love of it, and our sometimes hatred of Enterprise. And season three has to be the most irregular, the series that has the most good, the best episodes, and then the worst episodes. You never know what you're going to get into when you sit down to watch Enterprise season three. At least tonight, we were able to do an episode that I think most fans are willing to agree. It's at least got a lot of great stuff going on. It is a very classic Star Trek sort of tale, and it's got some moving bits to it. I think it's really good, and I'm glad we were able to talk about it tonight.
I agree. It's one of those stories that season three, they got caught up with the serialization of the Zindi arc. And then they mixed in some of those traditional standalone episodes in the middle. And as it turns out, maybe the arc itself, if you follow it straight through, is exciting. But it turns out that some of these standalone episodes, like Similitude here or Twilight, for example, are some of the better episodes in the season. So yeah, in that sense, it is kind of uneven. But I really like this episode. And I recommend anyone, if you haven't really been watching Enterprise, go watch this episode. It's the 10th episode of the third season. You know, pull it up on Netflix and watch it. And you can see how Enterprise, when it's at its best, really is a great Star Trek series that can be enjoyed, I think, by any Star Trek fan.
Oh, yeah. I absolutely think that's true. It's perfect. Twilight might be another one to look at, although it depends on you knowing a little bit more about the Zindi stuff. So
you do need to know a little bit more. That's true.
Yeah. So this one's definitely on my list of, if you haven't seen Enterprise before, check out this, get a sense of it. And hopefully on a future episode, we can have Doug and Jose on and we can argue about North Star because I despise it and they seemed to really like it. So I don't know.
We should do that. That's a good idea. All right. Well, one thing I wanted to circle back on from last week, Greg, in closing, is we talked a little bit about Anthony Montgomery's Project Chariot on the show last week. And I was lucky enough to get Anthony to get on the phone with me last week. And we talked about Chariot and did a whole interview, about 40 minutes worth, in fact. And I put that out on the Latest Matter stream. So if anyone's interested, both in Chariot itself, and we talked a little bit about Enterprise, you know, how he got the job on Enterprise and the role of Travis. Go over trek.fm/ms15 is the show page for that. You can stream, find it in iTunes, Stitcher, and everywhere. But as always, Anthony's just a wonderful guy. It's so much fun to talk to him. He's so cheerful and upbeat. And I think especially Enterprise fans, definitely go check it out. It was a really fun interview.
Yeah, Anthony's one of the people that I like the most outside of, you know, their role on the show. It's just, he's just such a great guy, and I'm really jealous that you were able to spend time on the phone with him, and I'll definitely be listening to this week's Matter stream. I hear that he got one of our catchphrases in there.
He did. And I didn't ask him to do it either. It just happened. It was pretty awesome. Wonderful. So it was great. All right. Well, let's tell people where they can contact us. If you would like to share your thoughts on today's show, anything we talked about, your thoughts on similitude, you can go to trek.fm/contact. And there's a form there. You can send us a message. It will come directly to Greg and me. And you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm, on Google Plus at hyperchannel/trekfmgplus, on ADN under username trekfm, and of course on Twitter under username trekfm. And Greg, Char, Landru, and myself are all tweeting from that account. So you can hit us up pretty much any time of day, wherever you are in the world, and hopefully someone will be around.
Yes, indeed. And I can personally be found at Greg Harbin, that's GregHarb as in boy, IN, where you can see me pretty much mostly crying about Last Resort being canceled. Yeah. And my podcasts, all of my favorite podcasts, they're just dying one by one. So a lot of tears for me on my Twitter account. So yeah, feel free to follow me there.
You can cry along with Greg.
Yes.
And you can find me on Twitter as well. My username is C. Brian Jones. It's Brian with a Y. And I tweet about Star Trek, of course, college football, Japan, design, music, all kinds of stuff. So give me a follow and give me an @ reply. Let me know that you followed so I can say hello to you. And I'll talk to you over there on the Twitters. Okay, Greg, I think we should just get everyone out of here. You know, I actually woke up this morning with a terrible back spasm. Actually, it was quite painful. And so I think what I need to do right now is go find T'Pol, because I could really use some of that Vulcan neuropressure.
All right, Chris. I think it's time to stick some of Tripp's DNA in it, because the Ready Room is done. Record. Recording.
Waveform.
Levels. Sims phaser pants. T'Pol's phaser pajamas. T'Pol has way too many meetings in her bedroom wearing pajamas. Like,
she wears pajamas I had also forgotten the wacky outfits that she was wearing throughout.
Yeah, they're all slightly,
little purple jumpsuits.
They're all slightly too small.
She resigned, so she doesn't have to wear the uniform anymore.
That's right. She was, yeah.
She was what?
She gets to wear whatever she wants.
You do know that Manny Coto has said that in season 5, she was just going to wear pajamas on the bridge at all times, right?
Just the pajamas with the pips.
With the pips, yes.